Thanks for downloading from WRTI. This is Jim Cotter. For more information on this and all the other programming you hear on the station, go to our website, wrti.org. While you're there, you might consider becoming a member, renewing your membership, or making an additional gift. This podcast and all of the programming you hear on WRTI is made possible by our listener members. Why not become one now? Thanks, and enjoy the show. Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Duke Riley. His installation, Reclaiming the Lost Kingdom of Laird, is on view at the Pennsylvania Historical Society as part of the inaugural Philographica Festival. David Patrick Stearns previews the Opera Company of Philadelphia's production of Tea by the Oscar-winning Chinese composer Tan Dun. We ride the L in West Philadelphia with artist Stephen Powers. He's the creator of Love Letter, a series of 50 rooftop and street-level murals. And we speak with Eddie Bruce. The Philadelphia crooner returns to town for a weekly residency following a successful stint in New York City. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
A new art installation at the Pennsylvania Historical Society in Philadelphia examines an unusual period in the history of a small island in the Delaware River. Petty's Island is now an oil storage facility belonging to Citgo, the Venezuelan national oil company, who will return it to the state of New Jersey by 2020 for use as a state park. Over the last several hundred years, the 292-acre island has served as a slave depot, a dueling ground, and a gambling den. Brooklyn-based artist Duke Riley has focused on the peculiar story of the island's last full-time resident, 19th-century Irish immigrant Ralston Laird, who raised a family there and proclaimed himself King of Petty's Island. The exhibition, Reclaiming the Lost Kingdom of Laird, includes artifacts excavated from the ruins of Laird's house, which Riley calls the Royal Palace, and commemorative ceramics celebrating some of Laird's living descendants. There are also photos and a video showing a mural of King Ralston's face, which Riley painted on top of one of the island's giant oil storage tanks. I met with Duke Riley at the Pennsylvania Historical Society earlier this week. So Laird arrives in Philadelphia in 1851, hangs around the city for less than 2 years, and heads off to found his own kingdom. Tell us a little bit about what sort of man or what sort of character you discovered in the process of putting this installation together.
You know, I mean, I read a lot of different articles about him, and, you know, it seemed that whenever anybody was doing any kind of story that had anything to do with the island, he was the guy that they would talk to, because he seemed like he was probably a pretty charismatic person, and everybody really liked him. The main family member descendant that I had contact with sort of had this idea of him being this kind of outcast sort of loner that lived on the island, when the reality was he was actually this incredibly community-oriented guy that did a lot of stuff to help these different immigrant families that were moving to the area to, you know, that he invited out to the island to kind of set up farms and help them get going in the new world. And he was definitely a very generous character, and he had 10 kids, several of them who died very young, which was obviously, that was kind of the norm back then, but he had 4 daughters that were born deaf and mute and had to deal with that, and it was obviously a different time and much more of a challenge. So yeah, he was definitely a pretty remarkable person.
You've historically been attracted to events in history that took place around waterfronts. Why is that, and then how did you come across this story?
I think that, you know, I mean, there's a couple different reasons, and, you know, you're sort of figuring these things out a little bit as you go along, too, and a lot of these places now are sort of serving a different purpose. They're sort of just like reflecting pools for condominiums, and usually I start looking at the areas around the waterfront. I mean, usually that's sort of where the history of the city begins, because the waterfront, wherever it may be, if the city's on a river or a lake, or played a significant role in why they set the city up there for, you know, whatever it may be, if they were using it for logging or if it was a port. You know, up until recently, those were less desirable places, though, to live in the city, and those areas were the periphery of urban society and took on more of a lawless dimension to them. And I think that also just typically that because of the constant flow of different people coming and going, just sort of the nature of that mentality and culture that sort of goes along with that. I think that generally it was sort of, they were more areas of tolerance too.
And how did you hear about Ralston Laird then, in this case particularly?
When I was invited down to do a project down here, I came to the Historical Society and started reading some different books and looking around, and then also taking these little day trips out and exploring some of the different waterways around the area. And you sort of look at maps and you see different islands and things, and then you look them up and you start reading about them, and that was sort of where I found out about this history and became more interested and started doing more research.
What has come from this is, we throw the word multimedia around, but what's come from this is very much a multifaceted installation. You've got archaeology, you've got genealogy, you've got a little bit of politics thrown in. There's some wonderful ceramics that kind of mimic the decorative commemorative plates that are usually made for, shall we say, the more traditional royal families.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of the idea. Like, I uncovered this history of this guy and was reading all these articles where they refer to him as the king, and then I guess I started thinking about how I was going to try and represent that, and then there's sort of like a little bit of an element of fantasy to it to some degree, that I was like, well, what if we just kind of acknowledge him as a real king? And actually what happened was, I was working on this drawing of the family tree as I was tracking down different people, and I was sort of trying to come up with a template for how I was going to do the drawing, and was looking up all these different things about heraldry, and I kept stumbling across all of these commemorative plates of like Princess Diana and Prince Charles's wedding, and then I started reading more about it, and I remember my uncle used to collect some of these plates when I was a kid, and they were all made from the Franklin Mint, and then I started reading more about the different plates, and I realized that most of these commemorative plate places all got started in the Philly, Pennsylvania area. So I thought that was kind of cool too. I guess the other thing too is that it's supposed to be a print biennial. And they asked me to come down and do a project, and then I was like, well, what am I going to do to actually really demonstrate that I'm doing something here
that's related to printmaking?
Print. But I didn't want to just check two things off in a box and said, okay, I did the project, now I'll make a print, and then I'll say that's why I'm involved in this thing or something, I guess. But then it kind of made sense. I was like, all right, because these plates, it's like a printing process. It's a reproduction. So I was contacting all the different family members and trying to get their correct birth date, and I just decided I would try to give them some sort of royal title based on how closely related they were to the king. And then if they're a duke or a count or something, then they have to be a duke or a count of something. So I would look up whatever the county that they were currently living in. Then I did like a little portrait of each person, most of which I would get off of like their Facebook page. Some of the people didn't, were a little bit harder to reach, and we managed to track down different photographs from family members.
Duke Riley. His installation, Reclaiming the Lost Kingdom of Laird, runs through April 9th at the Pennsylvania Historical Society. It's part of the Philadelphia-wide Philographica, a festival celebrating the role of print in contemporary artistic practice.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The Opera Company of Philadelphia usually produces grand opera about grand things such as freedom, love, and death. In their latest production, all of these things are encompassed in an opera by the Oscar-winning composer Tan Doon about something seemingly small, tea. Subtitled A Mirror of Soul, the opera is a hybrid of Eastern and Western music performed with a ceremonial formality that assures audiences that the subject is something much greater than just a simple beverage. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns visited rehearsals for the East Coast premiere of an opera unlike anything local audiences will have previously seen.
Lucky for audiences that Tea is subtitled A Mirror for Soul, because many Westerners aren't likely to know or understand how tea ceremonies in Asian cultures are a source of contemplation and reconciliation. Opera goers should be used to a certain amount of cultural distance, since the art form is full of values and manners that reflect long gone centuries. But the Opera Company of Philadelphia's Robert Driver knew little about any of this when he walked into a tea production at the Santa Fe Opera in 2007. Scenes weren't built on the usual peaks and valleys of operatic tension. The plot was there but unfolded gradually and fitfully, something like a Handel opera. Yet such elements weren't a barrier for him because so many other aspects of tea made him want to live in that world for a few hours.
I was just enchanted from the first moment it started. I just thought the whole the whole piece just caught my attention. And just this mixture of Asian and Western music. And I thought, oh my gosh, I've got to bring this to Philadelphia. I don't have any special knowledge of say, the Asian culture or these things, but I just let the whole thing wash over me, and it was a total experience.
Typically, the mere mention of a Chinese opera suggests bizarre, abrasive vocal style and ear-bashing percussion. But few composers have been as savvy about translating an Asian aesthetic to Western ears as Tan Dun, who has a side career composing scores for films such as Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. The core of his musical aesthetic is a longtime fascination with the remnants of folk culture in his native China, not just the songs that have survived the centuries, but elemental sounds used to make that music with basic materials such as stones, water, and paper. How interesting could that be? Well, rattling huge sheets of paper on stage sounds like this. Unlike Tan Dun's later, more westernized opera for the Met, The First Emperor, Tea is based on a simple, distinctively Asian six-note melody. But it's not likely to be a problem for audiences. In fact, the Asian cast members, such as Hai Jin Fu, hear it as being more West than East.
For Chinese audiences, this is not Chinese opera. No, I won't say even close. Chinese opera is totally different.
Characterizations aren't the usual blood and guts figures of grand opera. Often, the characters are more like sociological symbols representing something much larger, often a cultural touchstone, not unlike the deities of Baroque opera. Mostly, though, the singers can't worry too much about the much larger part. Tenor Roger Honeywell, for one, is more preoccupied with singing while moving in his 30-pound frock coat in this lavish $1.5 million production.
What's interesting about characters on a stage, we don't ever have to figure things out. We're a color in that painting, in that strange impressionistic painting. I'll play blue and green tonight. So we don't really have to analyze. It's not our job to analyze. Our job is to play those colors as vibrantly as we can.
Some cast members, such as Hai Jin Fu, don't even ask themselves why the opera seems to work so well.
We've done in Tokyo, Amsterdam, and lots of different places. It seems that people they liked it very, very much. Sometimes I ask myself, why?
There's the sketch of a linear story here, but it's more of an overall feeling of the entire event. It's more of an event, really. And during that second act, it just time sort of stands still. It just opens up. Basically, you can hold the plot in a teacup, pardon the pun. But, I mean, it's not really that important. It's just the overall arc of the experience that is important, which can be very illuminating.
In an art form known for its dizzying high notes and other visceral thrills, Tea is an opera that needs to be contemplated. Underneath the production's dazzling surfaces lies psychological stimulus that's likely to be different in any given encounter, depending on how the listener is feeling that day. What does it mean? There's no right answer. There's only your answer.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. With music by Tan Dun and an English libretto by Tan Dun and Yu Ying, the Opera Company of Philadelphia's production of Tea, A Mirror of Soul, opens Friday and runs through February 28th at the Academy of Music in Philadelphia. Riders on SEPTA's elevated train through West Philadelphia are being treated to a view of an unusual public art project painted on rooftops and walls along the Market Street corridor. Love Letter is a series of over 50 murals, each an artistically designed love note. Artist Stephen Powers grew up in the neighborhood and as a teenager was intrigued by the artistic and social possibilities of graffiti. This project is about inspiring and uplifting residents of the surrounding neighborhoods. Your ever after is all I'm after, reads the text on the 6100 block of Market Street. At the 5100 block, if you were here, I'd be home now. Another Muren message is, prepay is on, let's talk till my minutes are gone. Earlier this week, I spent several minutes talking to Stephen Powers. So going to school, this area was part of your commute. You were looking at the rooftops that you ended up painting on. In your previous life as a graffiti writer, did you leave your mark on any parts of West Philadelphia?
As a youth growing up, as a 7th, 8th to 12th grader, I took the train every day and was inspired by, you know, there was literally graffiti going back to the late 60s on these rooftops out here. And I spoke my piece along the rest of them. I climbed up on these rooftops, I painted my name, I tried to contribute something to the general cacophony that was happening out here. And what's important to note is I started writing graffiti as a 16-year-old, and you know, I had a much more developed worldview about what graffiti was and should be and could be. And I had a passionate thirst at the time to be an artist. So while I didn't make any graffiti that would qualify as art necessarily, I was very mindful of putting it in good places, not really stepping on people's toes so much, and really visually trying to provide as much entertainment as I could for the riding public and the passerby.
And those graffiti years, were they sort of a part of the learning of the artistic, the crafts necessary to become an artist proper?
When I was a youth and wanted to be an artist, I couldn't really connect the dots between my life and the lifestyle of being an artist. I mean, when I was growing up, people used to just shake their heads and feel sorry for me that I would, you know, was determined to be an artist. They felt like, oh, well, you've committed yourself to a life of poverty and penury and possible psychotic episodes, and, you know, good luck with that. And for me, the art exercises I was taking in school were just awfully boring. And graffiti had everything I wanted in the way of art. It had line, it had color, it had design.
And exposure.
Exposure and possible social commentary, if I was so inclined. And I was. And it's important to note, when I started as a 16-year-old in 1984, the Philadelphia Anti-Graffiti Network started. And there was a guy on my TV set that was the director of the Anti-Graffiti Network telling me there was no artistic and no political graffiti in Philadelphia. And I thought, hey, that's a niche. I could do that. So I did.
You divide your career into two phases. There's the graffiti writing phase, and then is there a cutoff point where you say, now I'm an artist? Or what dictated that point where you said, now I'm going to be a proper artist?
Literally, there was a point, I think, in 1998 where I just pulled out the beret and smock and said, I'm going this route for a while. But really, it was a little, slightly more gray area than that. I brought in a lot of the things that I was doing as a graffiti writer. I just stopped writing on people's stuff. I kept the same attitude. I kept the same visual dynamic. And the things that interested me writing graffiti continue to interest me as an artist.
With this love letter project, what dictated the individual murals? Was it your voice and indeed the slogans that you were painting? Was it the location? What was the starting point?
The love letter project was determined completely by the locations that we painted the individual phrases. I had maybe 5 or 6 sketches of things that I thought would work, and the rest were improvised and made on location, depending on the day and depending on what was to be done. We did a lot of community meetings, something I'd never done before as an artist or as a graffiti writer, to stand in front of a room and, you know,
so
talk
I'm
about
put this in your neighborhood.
Yeah, I'm going to put this in your neighborhood, and I don't look like any of you. And, you know, it's going to reflect everything that you're thinking. And there was a bit of incredulity on the part of the neighborhood that I was going to actually follow through on these promises. But I was genuinely interested in creating work that the neighborhood took ownership of, and they have, because it does reflect a lot of what West Philly brought to me in the way of their concerns and the things that they were interested in and the phrases that were interesting to them and they thought reflected their worldview. And being here and working here 6-9 months and working with the people that we worked, you know, we had an open door policy where the best idea won. And we got some great ones, and, you know, we polished up a few, and some were totally unadulterated, and a lot were old ideas that I had that I just reconfigured to fit what was out here.
The short brushstrokes of this project, when I've been explaining to people, the easiest way for me to explain to them was to quote some of the phrases. And the reaction is almost always been, oh, isn't that sweet? Were you aiming for, oh, isn't that sweet, or they're not all sweet?
Not all the phrases are sweet. I was looking for something that was a little bit more bittersweet, that was a little more about the give and take of relationships. I've been in a relationship, committed relationship, for 22 years now. As such, I know it's a give and take. It's an ongoing concern. It's a full-time job, and it never stops. And I wanted to show that, and I wanted to show the multidimensionality of love and how it fills cracks, if you allow it to. And painting these walls, you know,
cracks.
Yeah. We literally filled cracks with love and paint, and we really tried to just create something that it has sweet points, it has angry points, it has a lot of places in between. There's melancholy. There are phrases that sound like they could be written by somebody in jail to a loved one. And what the overriding thing that we wanted was, we wanted to be from one person to another, but we wanted to have meaning for everybody. And we also wanted to be from West Philly to West Philly.
They're all short phrases. Did the amount of time that the passengers on the L would have to look at them impact on what phrases went where?
Absolutely. The shortness of time that people have to look at the phrases impacted the length of them. Also, the length of the wall, the heights of the walls. Most of the walls that we painted are typically 10 feet high by 60 feet long. So dimensionally, it favors 2, 3, 4 words at max. So we try to keep it short, and ideally we're trying to reach 17-year-olds. We're trying to reach kids that are on the brink. They're at risk. They're ready to make good or really bad decisions for the rest of their life. So we wanted to be there for them. Like the first community meetings that we had, we heard from a couple kids that were just saying that when they're on the train, they look out the windows just to give themselves something to look at. So if that's the case and that's what they're up against, we wanted to provide something for them. A reaffirming message that maybe not for you, but there is love out there. And if you know it's out there, maybe you could make it for you. So another thing that happened in the course of painting these expressions were some of them we just screwed up. I had guys like painting things that they got the wordage wrong, but the right words were the ones that fit. So
give me an example.
Up on 52nd Street, there's a wall that says, I think I originally wanted to say, this heart is a safe for what's valuable. And it ended up being, this heart is safe for valuables, you know. So it was a bit of editing on the spot that made it better by chopping it down. And the guys were literally like halfway done going like, oh, that's not going to fit. But, you know, this is going to work even better. I learned to let go from the start. So from early on, I let people make their own decisions on their painting. And there was nothing but good results came from that.
Is there any sort of a narrative arc to this? If I read them in order, is there an overriding message? Or did you have to be careful that you didn't have too many cute messages or too many angry messages in a row? Or did you curate it in that way?
There's no narrative arc to the love letter. It's more you can jump in at any point in time and get what you need from it. If you only see one of the messages, you get the idea. If you see them all, it's a greater cumulative effect. And we are definitely looking to place phrases in good places where they would resonate the best.
Stephen Powers. His murals are on view from SEPTA's Market Street L from 46th through 63rd Streets. A special 5 miles per hour love letter train will convene tomorrow, Valentine's Day, at Love Park Fairmount Park Visitor Center at 16th Street and JFK Boulevard in Philadelphia. More information at muralarts.org. Although the great jazz pop crooners like Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, and Tony Bennett still have an audience, a new crop of younger singers like Michael Bublé, Peter Cincotti, and Robbie Williams have all had recent huge worldwide success. Philadelphia native Eddie Bruce is something of a bridge between the two. He remembers seeing many of the greats perform, but isn't quite young enough for teen appeal. After a sold-out run last year at Philadelphia's Prince Music Theatre and highly popular shows at the Metropolitan Room and at Feinstein's in New York City, Bruce is back in Philly for an ongoing Wednesday night residency at the Orchid Room at Mushulu, the restaurant on a 4-masted tall ship permanently docked on the Philadelphia waterfront. Bruce says his aim is to recreate the nightclub style of the 1950s and 60s when the great crooners were at their peak.
Is there or are there songs been written today, or can you think of any songs even, I don't know, in the last 20 years that would merit a place at this point in the Great American Songbook?
Absolutely, and that's something I try to always talk about in my shows, and that is that because I sing these songs does not mean I don't believe there's great music being written today and in the last 20 years. I mean, if you look at a song like How Do You Keep the Music Playing or Here's to Life, that Shirley Horn did so well. If you look at Dave Frischberg and the song, some of his songs, there are songwriters in New York like John Buccino and Stephen Lutvak and, I mean, countless others who are writing, still writing great music, and it's melodic. The lyrics are intelligent and thoughtful and thought-provoking, and, you know, you have to find it because it's not the mainstream music anymore.
Right, I mean, it's not Sammy Kahn or Cy Coleman or any of these people.
No, it's not, and it's not, and it's not coming from Broadway shows. It's the pop music comes from. If you saw the Grammys the other night, you see where it comes from. So it's not the mainstream anymore. So you have to mine a little deeper for it. You have to look for it. It's not going to be. When I was a kid, if I wanted to find a new song to sing, I went to the sheet music store and I looked for see what the latest Broadway show was and what the ballad was and what the song from that show was going to be a hit. You don't do that anymore. You don't get that opportunity. You have to look for these songs.
There is something of renaissance, though, in the realm of the crooner. We have people like Michael Bublé and Peterson Cotty, young guys who have taken this up. You're not of the age that you remember the Sinatra in Vegas. You're also of a younger generation. How did you come to this music?
That's very flattering, but I am of that
age. Oh, really?
Oh. Yes. At 6 years old, I went to a nightclub for my birthday in Philadelphia, the Latin Casino, before it was even in Cherry Hill. And ostensibly, my mother took me there to see the Three Stooges. That's who was performing there. But an interesting thing happened. They were the opening act for Ella Fitzgerald.
Wow.
A strange pairing, I know. I don't know whose idea that was. But and at 6 years old, Ella came out, and I was mesmerized, and I was hooked. And I started to listen to Ella and Sarah Vaughan and Carmen McRae and ultimately Sinatra and then Bennett and my love for the Great American Songbook and the jazz approach to singing those songs grew. And that, I mean, that's where I live. That's where my heart is. So I'm really grateful to see Michael Bublé and these guys doing this music and doing it well. I wish I had their careers. I think I was about 20 years too late for the Renaissance, you know, but that's okay. I don't like Rod Stewart's approach to this music at all. I don't think he gets the music at all, but I'm grateful to him for exposing it to 50 billion people who bought his records. So it's out there. I'm glad people are listening to it because it has to be performed if it's going to maintain.
Hi-ho the merry-o, play it on the stereo, all the way, baby, take your shoes off, we're not going dancing, kiss me like before, let the fire roar, throw another pillow. Learn what love is made of. What are you afraid of? Put Sinatra on. Now the gang is gone. Do it one more time.
Eddie Bruce. His weekly Wednesday night residency is at the Orchid Room at Mashulu at 401 South Columbus Boulevard in Philadelphia. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under their music director, Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan, our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.